30 minutes of argument for the relator, 30 minutes of argument for the respondent, 15 minutes of rebuttal argument for the relator. The arguments presented this morning will be taped by the marshal for the convenience of the court. If any of the parties to the case desire to hear those arguments, hear the tapes of those arguments, you may make application with the clerk of the court to do so. We are now ready to proceed with the oral argument, and we are ready to hear oral argument from the relator.
Mr. Buckwood and Mr. Harold Hammond will present arguments for the relator. Mr. Wood will open.
May it please the court, my name is Buckwood, and I am counsel for our relator, Ron Carr. The matter before the court, as I'm sure the court is aware, is of somewhat of unusual nature. It is predicated upon a long history of the state of a tradition, both constitutional and statutorily mandated, of having elected officials. In 1876, when we adopted our present constitution, the people of this state had seen a decade of government in which most elected, most executive officials and most judiciary officials were in fact appointed. That was rejected by the framers of the Constitution in 1875, and the Constitution that they adopted in 1876, but adopted by the people, was a system of elected officials in all branches of government. Even our governor and lieutenant governor, both not only elected, but did not require to be members of the same party. The Constitution prescribed that the elected officials would also be the attorney general, the controller, the treasurer, and later on, other officials that were created, such as the land commissioner and agriculture commissioner, were all created as elective offices. While some might criticize this approach to government, it was certainly the approach that the people chose to take in adopting our present constitution. Almost exactly a century later, in 1974, another constitutional convention was convened in Austin, Texas, and a new constitution was drafted. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your point of view, that constitution was not adopted by the people of the state. However, there was great attention given to all sections of that constitution, including the election of public officials as opposed to the appointment of public officials. And it can be said that the framers of that document were still in accord with the provisions that were adopted in 1876, in that they did not seek to change our system of elected appointed officials in favor of an appointive system. This constitutional scheme of having elected officials whenever possible has been carried out by our legislature. The legislature, through the years, has followed this policy of returning the power to the people whenever possible to elect their officials instead of having them appointed. In cases of vacancies during midterm, the governor, under the Constitution, has the appointment power. However, the Constitution contains a phrase that says that these interim appointments can be handled in a manner provided by law. And determining how when the vacancy occurs is a matter to be determined by law. Prior to 1967, if a vacancy occurred in midterm, it would be filled at an election if it occurred during a time when an election would be, if the actual vacancy occurred during the time when the vacancy could be filled by an election. This would mean that if someone resigned as of November 1, even though they submitted their resignation much earlier, that It would be filled by appointment because the actual effective resignation would not be until November 1, which was too late to have an election at that point. In 1967, the legislature, in a fairly major rewrite of our election code, made one of the changes that they made was that they opted to create a vacancy not at the time the vacancy actually took place, not at the time the resignation actually took place, but at the time that the resignation was submitted and accepted. This was done for the purpose of taking that resignation that might have been November 1 or December 1, but which was submitted much earlier. It was for the purpose of allowing the people to fill that vacancy at that next general election. There's really no argument about, I believe, about the intent of the legislature in 1967 when they amended Article 13, 12A to say that instead of waiting until the person actually left office, we would start our election process at the time the resignation was submitted and accepted. That has been carried forward into our present election code, and those provisions are contained in section 2001 and the following sections. However, we have experienced, and I would represent to this court, that there have been some problems, and they didn't originate with this administration, whereby an executive officer that was the authority to accept the resignation, in some cases it's not necessarily the governor, it may be a county judge, simply held on to the resignation for some period of time. And there have been a few instances in the past that I'm aware of where this has occurred.
Can you fill us in on the background where this has occurred at a statewide level with the governor?
On a statewide level, I'm not sure I remember one on a statewide level.
Well, I mean, with the governor as the
I remember. I remember a situation not too many years ago on a Court of Appeals position during Governor White's term where resignation was submitted and later withdrawn. And I don't remember the exact period of time, but I remember that the resignation was in the hands of the governor for a few weeks, if not longer. And then the resignation was withdrawn, resubmitted at a later date, and it created an appointment instead of having an election. I also remember that the Republican Party was very upset by that and proceeded almost to the point of filing suit. I happened to have been personally consulted. I wasn't an attorney in the matter, but I happened to be personally consulted in it, and I was familiar with that. I've seen other situations where governors have held resignations for some periods of time to change dates of election, on calling elections. Those situations, while not common, they have occurred. I believe
elections... Has there ever been a lawsuit filed before on any of those matters that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of. I believe that by the passage of recodification that was passed in the election code in 1985, that became effective late in 1985 and 1986, that the legislature dealt with this problem. And passing section 201.001 of the election code, for the first time, the legislature set out what really constituted a resignation. That was never very clear before. Presumably, a resignation could have been oral, and presumably it could have been equivocal. The legislature, in passing 201.001, said that to be effective, public officer's resignation must be in writing, signed by the officer, delivered to the appropriate authority, and it continues, a resignation must be accepted by that authority. Now,
doesn't that seem to imply that the governor listens to that for discretion, whether to accept it or not?
I believe that the governor has some discretion, and I will state to the court that I believe that he has the discretion to determine if it meets those requirements, that it's in writing, and it's signed, and it's appropriately delivered. I don't think he has to accept one that he's not sure where it came from. Something turns up on his desk and he doesn't know who actually sent it and where it came from. If it appears to be an order but it's not signed, or if he gets an oral resignation, I really do not believe he has to accept those resignations.
So your argument then is if it meets the elements of the resignation in the election code, he has no discretion whether to accept it or not?
I do not believe that he has any discretion whatsoever.
Counselor, is there any legislative history on that last sentence there? A resignation must be accepted by the governor, by that authority.
Your Honor,
for example, was there any previous draft that had said a resignation must be accepted by that authority to be effective? Was anything in the previous drafts of that?
I have researched that, and I have not been able to determine exactly where that language was inserted. I think that language actually came from some earlier drafts. The 1985 recodification was the end product of a long process that had begun much earlier.
You don't have any indication of legislative history?
I do not know.
That the words could have been added to be effective?
They could have been. I would think if you wanted to interpret it that way, the obvious way they should have written it was a resignation to be effective must be accepted by that authority. But
well, let's take it on the apparent meaning, the resignation must be accepted by the governor. Since we lack mandamus authority over the governor, how can you make this sentence operative?
The sentence is operative because it is a position of relators that the resignation, once some reasonable time passes for the governor to make some determination about whether it meets the requirements set out in 001, that once that has occurred, that resignation is effective as a matter of law, that the legislative scheme cannot be frustrated or thwarted by an interpretation that would allow a chief executive, whether it be the governor or county judge or some other executive, to one, maintain that person in office for as long as he wished or she wished, and two, clearly deny and frustrate the legislative scheme for electing officers. Let me give you an example of why I think that language is here. And we'll use the governor as an example, it's an obvious example. Someone, statewide official, could resign as of last day of December during his term, in midterm, when the next year was an election year. There's no question, none whatsoever, that this constitutional and statutory scheme was intended to provide for people to be able to file for the primaries for that job, run in the primaries, both parties or three parties or whatever number of parties there are, that election process would continue just as if it was the ordinary election process if a term had ended. It would be a general election, and that person would be elected by the people. To interpret this section any other way is clearly to invite the situation whereby the governor could say, well, my favorite candidate may not be able to make it to the primary, but I think I can get him to the executive committee. So he just doesn't accept it. In effect, denies the people the primary process. If, on the other hand, gets into the summer, doesn't look too good in the executive committee, he's not sure his favorite candidate that he was going to appoint to that position, or maybe has appointed to that position, can even get the executive committee nomination. No problem. Simply hold on until after the dates, which is this year, I think, is about September the 7th. And therefore, his appointment, when he finally makes it, will be set there for 2 years and be an incumbent.
Was there any legal proceeding with, in respect to Senator Farabee's resignation? Apparently that's what you were referring to a moment ago, sitting on it.
I wasn't on it.
To postpone the date of the special election. Was there any litigation involved in that?
No, there was not, and I wasn't really actually referring to that one, but that is another example. I was referring to one that Governor Conley did in 1967-68, but that is another example.
Is there any constitutional mandate that the governor must accept resignations as a state official?
Constitutional mandate?
Yes. Or is that purely statutory?
I think that is purely statutory. The Constitution says that these vacancies shall be filled as prescribed by law. To that extent, that gives the legislature the constitutional authority to set up that statutory scheme. But beyond that, I know of nothing mandated in the Constitution.
Then, if we're talking about how legislation could have been written, if the meaning of this sentence is as you say it is, that there's a lot clearer way of saying that a resignation is automatic when it's improper form than this final sentence of 201.001.
There is also a much clearer way to say it if it doesn't intend that. If it doesn't mean what it says, it actually means, I think it reads quite well, a resignation must be accepted by that authority.
But it doesn't say when, does it? I mean, I'm thinking of when Chief Justice John Hill decided to resign, he said, I am resigning effective January 1st, and this was back in October and November, wasn't it? And he kept on working until then. You're saying, under your indication of this, your interpretation is that if an office holder decides to resign, that it is immediately and there's no choice. Is that right?
Insofar as, no, it doesn't take him out. It doesn't take the individual out of the office. It is just for the purpose of triggering the election process. And I really don't think there's any question that that statute was passed for that purpose, is making certain that the election process started even though the person wouldn't be out of the office for some period of time. I really don't think there's any way that anybody could construe 1312A and its successor to mean anything else. What we have a question here is, did the legislature intend to give the governor the unbridled discretion to prevent that whole system from working? Now, I hope, and I apologize, that the court has been furnished with a site of a case that we only located the day before yesterday and yesterday. It's a Texas Supreme Court case of Kilday versus Germany. Now, this was decided in 1942. I don't think that anyone would accuse the court in 1942 of being one that was overly concerned with legislating, but they were concerned with making sure that this legislative scheme to elect public officials be carried out. What happened is that Jerry Sadler, who had been elected to the Railroad Commission for a six-year term, decided he was going to join the Navy. He had an aide, and he decided that he would make that aide the next Railroad Commission. The way that he was going to do that was that he was not going to tell anybody that he was going to resign except his aide, which he did. He also knew the filing deadline, even to fill vacancies, was on June 1st at that time. So he waited around until June 1st, the last minute, and resigned, delivered his resignation to the governor. And by the way, the case will indicate that the governor probably never accepted that resignation. Mr. Sadler had his aide go down and file, and lo and behold, the filing deadline passed because nobody else even knew that the position was vacant. The statutes here were quite clear. That was the filing deadline. There was no provision for extending the filing deadline, and suddenly we had a situation where this whole scheme for electing public officials had gone by the wayside. Mr. Kilday was going to be the Railroad Commissioner. Well, the Democratic Party said, we're not going to let that happen. They reopened filing even though there was no authority to do it. They took applications and certified them for the ballot. Mr. Kilday, of course, went to court. The Supreme Court of this state in 1942, and there's some very, very able lawyers. I was amazed at the number of lawyers involved in this whose names are still prominent. Mr. Kilday went to court and said, the statutory scheme is clear. Statute, the filing deadline closed as of June 1. And the court said, that can't be the law. If that's the law, then we will have a complete frustration of our election system. And they said, it is not intended to apply the statute, to apply in unusual circumstances, where there would not be a reasonable opportunity for candidates for such nominations to comply with the law. If we should hold that the statute in question was applicable, Mr. Kilday's name would be the only one that would be allowed to appear on the ballot for such nomination. And as a consequence, he would become the nominee of the party without the party having a reasonable opportunity to have other nominees. It would be unreasonable to hold that the legislature had intended to render it impossible for the party to protect itself in such a situation. Now, this was the Supreme Court of Texas. It was 1942. It's a unanimous opinion. And what they're saying is that we're not, and they go on to say, that courts will not follow the letter of the statute when it leads away from the true intent and purpose of that legislation. There can be no doubt that the true intent and purpose of this legislation is to make certain that a resignation such as this simply can't be sat on. It can't be allowed to frustrate the electoral process.
In that case, Mr. Wood, the court, I think very carefully in the last paragraph there, the opinion, did not answer the question whether or not the governor had to accept the resignation or had accepted it.
That's correct.
And that's really a crucial point with us, isn't it? And you suggested a while ago that the words resignation must be accepted in the case the governor had to accept it. His only discretion was to determine if it were in accordance with the law. How much time did he have to do that? What is a reasonable time?
Your Honor, I would say that a reasonable time, and the courts are faced with this question every so often, certainly is not 5-6 months. It might be a few weeks. Well, it might be enough time to look at it. He might be out of town.
It gets into a matter of fact, doesn't it?
I think the court can hold as a matter of law what a reasonable time is, and I think that has done numerous times by this court, other courts, what a reasonable time is under a particular statute as a matter of law. We're not faced with a situation with a governor holding one 2 weeks. We're not faced with a governor holding one 2 months. We're faced with a situation which I presume that we don't know how long the governor will hold it. He's held it now for some number of months while he has been accepting other people's resignations and making appointments and filling vacancies. At the same time, he is choosing not to accept this one.
Mr. Wood, I want to return to a question that Justice Spears asked about legislative history. Is there any reason that the language that the resignation must be accepted by that authority appears in the election code rather than someplace else in the revised civil statutes?
Your Honor, the only reason I can see is to deal with the problem that we have at hand. I don't know whether it should be a general provision that would be in other statutes. I do not know of anything in other statutes that is of this nature. I would suggest that we have a situation here where we have no doubt of what the legislative scheme is. We have no doubt of what the legislature intended insofar as filling these vacancies by election, if possible. We have a person who has met all the qualifications, all the requirements of the resignation. What we have is the respondent asking this court to say, place an interpretation on the statute that will allow the appointing authority, in this case the governor, absolute discretion in total frustration of that legislative plan. And I suggest to you that the authorities, that cases that this court is heading down, says we will not indulge in that type of interpretation. That type of interpretation will, if we don't have to, and you certainly do not have to here. The Kilday case, it's true, the governor there never accepted the resignation. In fact, Mr. Sadler had a change of heart and decided that he didn't really resign. Went to federal court. There was another case, Sadler versus Chester, where he tried to get his office back. The fact of the matter is, they took it as operative that the vacancy had occurred, and they were not going to allow Mr. Sadler's position to frustrate the legislative plan that these people were going to be elected and the people were going to have an opportunity to elect those officials. I'd like to give about my time to Mr. Hammett if that's possible. Thank you.
May it please the court, Harold Hammett, for the attorney for the State Democratic Executive Committee, Bob Slagle, Chairman. Mr. Wood has covered most of the points. I hoped I would not have to take the full time allotted to me, but rather to continue forth with a little bit of different emphasis concerning what the key question is. Is the key question here deciding in abstract the how much time the governor has to accept a resignation? I don't believe that with respect is the key question, because the governor doesn't have the responsibility of certifying to the county clerks, the Fulbright County election officials, the names of people to go in the general election ballot. That duty clearly is imposed under law on no one else other than the Secretary of State. In this instance, for the purpose of determining whether or not the vacancy, forthcoming vacancy in the office, should be filled within a short period of time by the election process, by the people, or should it be taken as an appointed power by the governor, depends on what the Secretary of State does for the purposes of this dispute, not just on what the governor does. And I would like, with respect to, and with the court's leeway, if you would give me to read just five or six sentences from the concluding portion of Kildade versus Germany to show that aspect. It's indicated, that's the case that Mr. Buckwood was discussing concerning Jerry Sadler's attempted effort to have himself, in effect, subvert the elective process by making his own appointment in the way that he tried to resign. Beginning at just at the bottom of page 188 of that case, and discussing the issues here involved, this is after the court held that the State Democratic Executive Committee properly reopened the filing to allow the electoral process to work and let the people choose rather than have one person choose a replacement. After deciding that, the court says, in discussing the issues here involved, we have assumed for the purpose of the disposition of this case that a vacancy had occurred in the office in question. We've done so because all parties to the suit asserted that such vacancy had occurred. But this is what's more important. Obviously, if the office is not vacant, Mr. Kilday, who seeks the injunction in this instance, has no interest that will be injured by the State Democratic Executive Committee in allowing the names of other candidates for such nomination to be placed on the ballot. On the other hand, if the office is vacant, then the committee, as above held, had a right to fix the time for applicants to file for places on the ballot. Since Mr. Sadler is not a party to this suit, and his right to continue in office is not an issue in this case, not here either, we refrain from here deciding whether he has resigned from or abandoned the office. It is also unnecessary, this is the key part, it is also unnecessary for us to determine whether the resignation, if any, occurred on June 1st or after that date. Now this is the emphasis, as I view it, in behalf of the party that has an interest in having someone to be selected by the people, and incidentally also in respect not just the Democratic Party, but also the Republican Party. As you note from the filing in the papers here, when Judge Esquivel submitted his letter of resignation, he did so in time where he stated whether it would be time to allow both the both political parties and the Libertarian Party, I think, to be able to fill the replacement by the nominating process and by a vote of the people.
Counsel, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Is this remainder of Judge Esquivel's term, is this an unexpired term, or
yes,
is this
end of his term coming up.
No, this is an under, the remainder.
How many more years retained on his term?
I think,
2 years?
This is the middle of it, yes.
2 years, so it's in the middle of
yes,
it.
Yes, I want to be sure that's correct.
Let me ask just a hypothetical question to see where I'm trying to fit the pieces. Suppose Judge Esquivel were before the governor, quote, accepts, unquote, the resignation, were to wait till after September the 7th and then withdraw his resignation. Could he do that?
He would wait until after, at this time that he would wait until after September 7th.
And then withdraw his resignation.
After someone, after, and is the court's question presuming that there had been someone who was selected by each of the two parties to run for that seat?
I suppose so.
All right. I think in that instance, I don't believe he could. The resignation...
It's not accepted by the governor yet. Why couldn't he?
According to the Carpenter case, if it's not been accepted, he can withdraw it.
Yes, Your Honor, but at that stage, if I'm recalling that case correctly, I do not know if that was in the instance in which someone had, the electoral process had already started previously to fill that vacancy.
San Antonio City policeman who resigned and changed his mind, and
right.
Mayor had not
right.
accepted.
Right, yes. That was not an instance in which the pervading statutory and ultimate constitutional scheme is that there be a continuity in office to be filled in the future by the electoral process. Now, if that were to have been the case, Your Honor, as indicated by this court in the Kilday opinion, that would be something that would be determined later on if the person did decide to try to seek that office back again. And in this instance, we could ask it even further. In this instance, suppose there is a party nominee. To raise this, but carrying this, both parties make a nomination, and from my viewpoint, I would not prefer this, but suppose the Republican candidate wins in November, and suppose up to that point then the governor decides to try to go ahead and make his own appointment. I suppose it's in the harshest terms there. Then that it would be determined at that point who has the right to the office, as indicated at this and by the court in the Kilday opinion. That is a question for later. The question now is the president in this court is that the Secretary of State is the only one who is standing in the way of making sure that if it turns out that the office is properly one to be filled by the people, that he not be allowed to block that. And on the authority of that case, we ask the court to grant the writ to force the Secretary of State to put these names on the ballot so that the vacancy can be filled, at least give the possibility, as in the Kilday case.
Mr. Hammond, you have an opportunity.
Excuse me. Sure.
I didn't mean to.
I'm finished. Go ahead. Thank you.
Have you had an opportunity to read the amicus brief that was filed? We just got it late.
No, I did not even know one had been filed, Your Honor.
Well, the governor's office has filed one, and I've just read it since.
I'd like to know.
Today, but I would like to, not all the judges are seated either, and I'm sure that you can get a copy.
I've been here since 8:15 this morning, Your Honor, and this is the first time I've heard about it. Is there any way we could get a copy of it right
I'm
quick?
I'm sure there.
According to the certificate of service, it was filed yesterday and sent to you in your office in Fort Worth.
Probably mailed.
Yeah. I don't have a copy on me to give one to, but I'm sure we can get you one. But there's one new twist in here, and I'm sorry you haven't read it, but so I'll try to make it. I'll try to make the question to try to explain it. Under Article 17 of the Texas Revised Civil Statutes, when there's an unexpired term and there's been an election for an unexpired term, immediately following the canvass, the elected person is entitled to take the office, and is supposed to take office. Judge Esquivel has resigned effective January 1. Stated reason, at least in some places, I don't know if it's in the letter, is because he won't have his retirement vested until he serves that long. It looks like there'll be a window there under the facts of this case when there are two people that want that office. Judge Esquivel has not resigned until the date of January 1. If there's an election, somebody else is qualified at the end of November. And if the possibility that you posited that the party you're representing doesn't win, there might actually be somebody that claims that office in November.
There may be, but again,
Is that not a problem, though, with the scheme of us ordering the Secretary of State to put this particular...
No, Your Honor, because with respect, it's not certain that that would occur.
Well, I know it's not certain it would occur, but we have somebody that's resigned for a date after the date that the election would make the winner entitled to take office.
The question would be, would the winner at that point want to go in and take the office at that time?
Let's say he does. This is what his question is.
In that instance, then he would have the right. He would have the right if he wanted to do it.
But there hadn't been a resignation for that day. The resignation is for a later date.
That's what I understand.
But somebody's just been elected for November.
If he wished in that instance, which I don't know the presumption that he would insist on it, on trying to kick out of office, they're the ones whose resignation has made it possible for him to be in the picture in the first place. But if he were to insist on that, then his remedy would be to go in and file a court warrant to try to see if the to get the officer removed.
You think the governor has to?
And
you don't think the governor has any discretion to say that a resignation for January 1 is not a resignation in these circumstances because an election that would be ordered to fill that term would be an election for a period that would cause an office to become vacant before January 1?
Because, see, the same factor would occur. The problem cancels itself out, if I understand the court's hypothetical. This court lets the Secretary of State, in conjunction with the governor, get away with this, and the governor appoints somebody, and that person then shows up on November 1st, when ordinarily the a term would begin, or November, whenever it is, and say, I, as the governor's appointee, want this office 6 or 8 weeks early.
There hasn't been an election in that event. I mean, there would be no statutory work. That person would have, as I understand it, I hope I'm not commenting on a future lawsuit, would have no statutory right to claim a job before there was a vacancy. But what I'm wondering, and I had frankly never thought of it until I just saw this amicus brief a few minutes ago, but is this an area that's within the governor's discretion? Mr. Wood listed an enumerated list of things that were in the governor's discretion. And might one of them be that this is a resignation for a time that is too late to be properly filled by an election?
Your Honor, I don't think it is, and clearly because the resignation, the notice of it, effectively of it, applies with the election code scheme that has been delegated by the Constitution of the legislature. Give emphasis that whenever there is an opportunity, if there is an opportunity for a vacancy in a state office to be filled by election rather than by appointment, then time deadlines will either be shortened or extended, as in the Kilday case, to accomplish that purpose.
Is there any outer limit on how far in advance somebody can move?
I don't know if we could probably posit I think, but Your Honor, this, with respect, that's not a question that's before us. I think we could posit one if one wanted to resign in the middle of the following year. But that,
I mean, if
we don't have that question before us here at this time.
If a judge's goal is maximization of democracy, theoretically one would want to resign before the primary filing deadline. We had a March primary
again,
this year, so you could have a resignation.
Drawing the distinction, though, Your Honor, between the time of resigning from fulfilling the duties of the office. Yeah, that's one thing. And is that the Constitution properly in states, and that is it's self-effectuating. A resignation from office is not effective until the successor is qualified and elected, whether the resignation is accepted by the governor or not. I mean, that's and there are cases on that. But that is not the issue in filling the office. And rare there's exceptions to that. If a person takes an incompatible office, which under the Constitution can't be held twice, well then it's automatic. But as a general rule, if it's a resignation and nothing else, there's got to be the successor qualified for that for the resignation to be effective. But the question here is not the filling of the office and carrying out of its duties now. It's whether the resignation announced in time to trigger the statutory scheme, how do you replace it, the emphasis as given by this 46 years ago by the court is you try to figure a way to do it so that the replacement can be by the people and not by the appointment of one person.
Any further questions?
Thank the court for its consideration.
Let me give a thought that you can answer on rebuttal. Do I understand the election code speaks to a vacancy in office? Now, when someone files with the governor an intent to vacate an office at a certain date in the future, when does a vacancy occur? Does it occur when the governor says, I accept your notice you're going to retire, you're going to resign, or did it occur at the date that person leaves office? And think about that
right,
and give some answers.
And may I wear out my welcome at the court? Is there some way we can get
one late for you?
All right.
A copy of mine. We'll be back in just a minute.
Thank you, Justice.
Yes,
Shelley, very much.
The court is now ready to hear an argument from relator, from respondent.
Mr. James Todd will present argument for respondent.
Have you by chance received a copy of the amicus brief?
No, Your Honor. Not only have I not received it, but let me just raise this technical point, perhaps alerting to the court to an argument for a future case, then I'll go on to the arguments I want to make here. I think there's room to question whether the governor can appear in this court, even in an amicus brief, except through the Office of Attorney General, since that he is apparently in this amicus arguing in his official capacity as governor. But I'll leave that to another case, and if the court finds anything of help in this friend of the court brief, then so be it. But I had not seen it and didn't even know it was going to happen. At the outset, I think that it's easy to understand the frustrations which lead the relators to come to this court and seek the relief that they're seeking. However, I think that in the law, there are some serious problems that pose obstacles to the relators obtaining the relief which they are seeking. And in my time here, I would like to just outline for the court what those problems are, because I think they're serious enough that they need to be addressed regardless of what the relief it is that the court may decide to grant. The first problem is that although this case is styled State Democratic Executive Committee and others against Jack Raines, it's really about the governor. I listened to the relator's remarks. I think there were at least 25 or more references to the governor. There was not a single reference to the Secretary of State until the last 5 minutes of argument, and then there were only two or three. Truly, if I may say so, the governor is the villain of this piece. This is a case about the governor, but the governor can't be mandamus. However, a governor could be enjoined, and this court has entertained cases in which an action for injunctive relief has been allowed against the governor. If the governor is acting if his acts are unauthorized by law, he may be enjoined notwithstanding sovereign immunity, and that's been well settled.
What would he be enjoined from doing in this case?
Well, I would imagine a district court, if it agreed with the relators, could enjoin him from declining to accept the resignation.
Isn't that a backdoor way of going in to say he has to accept it?
Right.
Isn't that the definition of mandamus?
Mm-hmm. Well, mandamus, I think, is appropriate, of course, where there's a clear legal duty. And
that's what we're talking about here.
Right. Well, but for the Secretary of State, I don't think the duty is so clear. It may or may not be clear for the governor. But for the Secretary of State, clearly the Secretary of State cannot certify the to a position that's not vacant. There has to be a vacancy. The statute does say that before there's a vacancy, the resignation has to be accepted. Now, under the current system, as it's been handled up until now, the governor makes some affirmative indication of acceptance and notifies the Secretary of State of that. And then the Secretary has nothing to decide. When he is notified that the governor has accepted a resignation, he knows to treat it as a vacancy. It doesn't leave any room for a decision or thought on the part of the Secretary of State. The theory that the relators are advocating would require the Secretary of State to make an independent determination as to whether or not there's a vacancy, regardless of what the governor has done. And by the way, let me respond to a question that was asked by the Chief Justice earlier. It is constitutionally mandated that the governor fill these vacancies. It's Article 5.
No, he has to fill them, but does he have... What I'm sure the relators to be arguing is that resignation happens automatically. I mean, the governor, whether he does or does not do anything, once he's had a reasonable time to check out the adequacy of the paperwork, it's an automatic thing, and that we can order the Secretary of State to do something.
Well,
the question was there something in the Constitution that said the governor has to have an active cognitive role?
Well, okay, I misunderstood the question. No, this court has said in the Sawyer case that acceptance must be, in effect, some sort of affirmative act and not passive. Either there must be a declaration, I accept, or there must be behavior that's consistent with accepting. But there's a real problem with interpreting this statute to make the resignation self-effectuating. For one thing, there would be no point in even providing for acceptance. If a resignation is complete upon it being written, signed, and delivered, what is the point of even talking about the governor accepting? Now, the legislature, by the usual rules of construction, it must be thought of as understanding how terms are used in the law. Well, offer and accept, the word acceptance is used in a number of legal contexts. And it usually includes the discretion to reject, and it usually implies some discretion. For example, if you offer to buy my house for $100,000, the contract's not complete until I say I agree, I accept. It isn't. It makes no sense even to talk about anybody accepting the kind of resignation that is contemplated in the theory that and this is a theory, like I said earlier, their frustration is understandable. This is a theory the relators have to advocate to achieve the result of mandamusing the Secretary of State to do something that they really want the governor to do.
Let's talk about this.
Okay.
Suppose on January the 1st, the governor refuses to accept. He just puts this letter in his back pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Is Esquivel still a judge, or can subject to the Judicial Qualifications Commission and so forth until the governor...
I would say, number one, under the holdover...
prohibited from practicing law and anything else until the governor decides I'm going to accept your resignation?
Well, one, I'd say under the holdover provision of the Constitution, there's that possibility because it does say that someone must continue in office until the successor is filled.
They have servitude.
Well, I guess the response to that, and I haven't seen it litigated, but I guess the response would be that whenever a public official takes the oath of office, he is at that point agreeing to accept the condition that he's going to stick around until there's a successor. That might be a more appropriate case for mandamus. I don't prejudge that case at all. I don't know how it would turn out. It certainly also looks like a good case for injunctive relief. I think one difference between mandamus and injunctive actions, frequently in the context of injunction, a court can weigh the equities and make a ruling of law for the first time. But I think since mandamus requires a clear legal duty, it's kind of anomalous to mandamus someone on the basis of a duty that doesn't exist or has not been understood to exist until the court, after weighing the equities, says this ought to be done.
Are you saying that district courts of this state have enjoined the governor to do an affirmative act?
Yes. For example, one case that comes to mind, I did give the cite to Mr. Hammock when he and I were talking about, because of the time constraints on this proceeding, we haven't briefed it as fully, like Clements versus Balyas, which is 620 Southwest 2nd 112, was a redistricting suit. And injunctive relief, I believe, by Judge Clark, I'm not sure, was granted in connection with the governor's role and other state officials in, I think, legislative redistricting. Another earlier suit went the other way, Jones versus Briscoe, which was 539 Southwest 2nd 228. The suit there was brought against the governor for entering into an interagency contract. The ruling of this court was, he was authorized by statute to enter into that interagency contract, and therefore injunction wouldn't lie. It was not significantly, the court didn't say you cannot get an injunction against the governor. It said because this particular act was authorized, therefore you can't. But I think, especially if you go back to Cobb versus Harrington and the line of cases from this court, it's quite clear that had they concluded the other way, that he was not authorized to enter into that contract, that he could have been enjoined by the district court from doing so. So that it is possible, it doesn't happen very often, but it is possible to, I say it doesn't happen very often, I don't see very many suits against the governor, but it's certainly in the law that is an option. The Kilday.
Let me ask you this question. Are you saying that Mr. Wood and Mr. Hammett walk down the street to the corner of 11th and Guadalupe and file an injunction against Governor Clements, that you're going to walk in and confess judgment?
I don't want to prejudge that case.
What are you telling us?
I think that they have a, that if they are correct, which I'm not saying, but if the theory of the relators is correct, that injunctive relief is the remedy they ought to be seeking and not mandamus. That doesn't decide, who knows, maybe the attorney, the authorized attorney for the governor would agree, or maybe they wouldn't, but that's for that case. But mandamus is not an appropriate remedy, although it does get one to the Supreme Court faster and has that advantage. I think that any consideration of this case has to confront the problem of the difference in standard for mandamus. And as I mentioned, the Kilday case, which was cited, that was the plaintiffs there didn't go to the Supreme Court to mandamus. That was an action for injunctive relief, and ultimately reached a result that solved the problem.
Mr. Todd, let me ask you this question. Focusing on whether or not the governor has any discretion to accept a resignation, and whether or not vacancy exists.
Right.
How does this case differ from Justice Wallace's resignation? Now, I'm not talking about the effective date of the resignation, mm-hmm. I'm talking about the governor's discretion. If I understand your argument, you're arguing today that Governor Clements could have and was legally authorized to sit on Justice Wallace's resignation, and there's nobody can done with about it, and therefore the governor could have manipulated or frustrated the system and then appoint an office holder to serve 2 years. Is that your argument?
I don't want that to be my argument. What I'm saying,
so
no, Your Honor, my argument is that mandamus is not the remedy for that situation. No, I don't think that it's necessary for a respondent to argue that the governor can do what he's doing in this case. The governor, let me repeat, is not the respondent here. It may well be true, and I think a very good argument can be made, that the governor doesn't have that much discretion. Clearly, the movement in the election code, I agree with Mr. Wood, the whole thrust of the law is a preference for filling vacancies by election rather than appointment. What I'm saying on behalf of the respondent, who is the Secretary of State, the Secretary of State's not sitting on this resignation. The Secretary of State, who has hardly been mentioned in this argument, is not the one doing it. So it may well be, I would be willing for purposes of these arguments to concede that there's something very, very wrong with what's happening on the withholding of the acceptance of this resignation, just as there was something very, very wrong in the Kilday case of the way the land commissioner tried to manipulate that, but to try to solve this problem by mandamus in this court poses some serious problems in the law, and I don't think that the decision which this court renders in response to this petition for mandamus can overlook those problems.
Maybe I wasn't listening carefully enough, but I don't think you still yet answered Justice Gonzalez's question.
Which is?
Well, for a time there, Mr. Mm-hmm. Hoffhines, the governor's appointment mm-hmm. secretary,
right.
indicated that because Justice Wallace had not given him enough time, that he didn't know if the governor would accept the resignation or retirement of Justice
right.
Wallace.
I read that with interest.
All right. Hypothetically, let us assume that the governor had not accepted Justice Wallace's retirement notice until after the deadline for placing people on the ballot. Would we be powerless to do anything about it?
By mandamus, I think the argument would be.
So the rule of law would be the same whether the retirement notice is for a future date past the election deadline or for a date before the election deadline.
I can't see that that's the critical distinction, the effective date. In fact, you know, the statute, it was mentioned earlier, was amended so that the effective date of the resignation is not the key point. It's the date of acceptance. As was mentioned earlier, the law used to be that there's no vacancy until the effective date of the resignation. And then they came back in 67 and said there's a vacancy when it's accepted. And so that's the key point.
Once this is accepted, does Judge Esquivel lose any right then to stay on?
Well, now that's...
Is that the answer to this problem that that the governor has just raised?
I think the holdover provision of the Constitution keeps him there hearing cases until a successor has been authorized
to take office. But you think his plan of delaying his retirement until his retirement benefits had vested might be entirely frustrated by this?
You know, that... We discussed that in preparation for this argument as to whether the effect of that 67 amendment was to require Judge Esquivel to leave office when his resignation was effective. I mean, when it was accepted, excuse me. I don't know the answer to that. It does appear that Judge Esquivel, the manner of his resignation is to, in some respects, to have his cake and eat it, to get out of office, but yet leave the opportunity for it to be filled by a successor from his party. And I don't know what price he might have to pay if the ruling of law is that it's been accepted. Maybe he does lose something there. I just don't know. Well, I believe my time has expired. I'm sorry, I've lost track of the clock.
Are there any further questions?
Well, on the kill date case, wasn't it before this amendment to the election code saying that it had to be accepted?
Oh, yes, it was before that.
About 20 years or more.
Right, the one thing I would say about that, which reminds me of that provision, the resignation must be accepted. I don't think that that's the best draftsmanship from the standpoint of either relators or respondents. I think that in context, the fact that it appears within a provision that is concerned with what it takes to make a resignation effective and not a general provision about what happens to resignations of public officials, that it's equally plausible to interpret that to be another precondition to effectiveness of resignation rather than any constraint on the discretion of the accepting authority. In other words,
any indication of legislative intent that would support that statement?
No, Your Honor, I don't. I don't find it. Just as Mr. Wood, I haven't found any. I think this is one of those where we have to look at it and interpret it in light of its context and the normal use of language and maybe try to reason it out logically.
It seems to me if you're correct, they shouldn't have added that sentence.
They shouldn't have done it that way. It would have been better to have a semicolon and say, and it must be accepted. They said, to be effective, a resignation must be in writing, signed by the resigning official, delivered, and accepted. That would have been a better way to do it.
Doesn't say that, though.
No, it does not say it.
It says in a separate sentence, a resignation must be accepted by that authority.
It's a separate sentence, yes. Yes.
I'm trying to figure out what the legislature had in mind. Let me ask you for a policy reason.
Okay.
That would support the interpretation you have given us today.
Okay.
Of this section. What possible reason could the legislature have had by saying that when somebody resigns, it's not effective until the governor gets ready to accept it?
Well, I think that goes to the whole notion of acceptance. And in the Sawyer case, the court discusses why it is that it says there's some argument for considering resignations as self-effectuating, that an unconditional resignation is effective upon submission. But the court went on to say that's not the better rule. It's better to require that a resignation is not complete, is not effective, until there's some act of acceptance. Now, in that case, they gave as one policy reason to leave the resigning official the ability to withdraw it if he should so decide. And also the very vesting in an official of authority to accept resignation, I think, recognizes that resignation from a public office is somewhat different than withdrawing or giving up some private position, that there's a public interest to serve. Ultimately, in the case of judicial officials from district court upward, the governor is the one charged with, he has some responsibility to make some determination as how the public interest may be served. I think it's to leave, the policy reason would be to leave the accepting authority, whoever that may be, some room in some cases to say it's not in the public interest for you to withdraw from this public office yet.
You want to give the Secretary of State that authority?
No, I don't. I don't think that's the whole point. The Secretary of State, we ought to consider the implications.
You want to give the governor that authority?
Well, I think the governor has it.
He says, I don't want you to resign. I want you to stay right there, especially until after the final deadline.
Okay, it is not an unchained discretion. It's not utterly unlimited discretion, and the existence of the remedy of injunction provides some way of addressing it. But certainly, I think we ought to consider the implications of giving to the Secretary of State discretion to make an independent determination as to whether a vacancy exists, regardless of what the governor has done, so that even in a case where other conditions precedent to vacancy in office may not occur, a Secretary of State may take it upon him or herself to say, this office is vacant, therefore I'm going to accept the certification of the other candidate. I don't think that the Secretary of State's office, I don't think, was intended to be the one to decide whether there's a vacancy. That's the term. The statute doesn't require that the resignation be sent to the Secretary of State. It says that a judge resigning has to send it to the governor. I think that indicates that it's not up to the Secretary of State to make a determination of vacancy, which is what's necessary for the relator's theory to prevail.
Have you done any research on the policy behind apparently allowing a court to enjoin a governor and the constitutional prohibition on this, on any court being allowed to mandamus?
Right, I have in other cases. There's sovereign immunity is a key issue and the separation of powers. So the doctrine that has evolved in Texas jurisprudence, which corresponds to the doctrine in federal jurisprudence, that ordinarily sovereign immunity prevents a court from compelling the governor to act, however, or other officials. However, if that official is violating the Constitution or his acts are not authorized, he is acting outside the scope of the authority he's been given to exercise, his acts are not the acts of the sovereign, and therefore sovereign immunity doesn't bar injunctive relief against it. In the federal jurisprudence, it's ex parte Young. In state, the Texas jurisprudence, Cobb versus Harrington, I think, is the seminal case on that, which this court has referred to a number of times. So that there is a window, to use a term used earlier, for proceeding judicially against the acts of the governor. It's not meant to be an across-the-board ability to challenge any discretionary act of the governor, but in some instances, and here, if the relators are correct, then it would mean the governor has no authority once he's received a bona fide resignation to do anything but accept it. So if their theory is correct...
But even if that theory is correct, is it clear we can mandamus the Secretary of State?
I don't think that... See, I've said earlier, I don't think the Secretary of State can be mandamused. You're saying if their theory is correct, does it still follow that the relators are entitled to a mandamus against the Secretary of State?
Yeah, it's a new
question. I think there's one other element that would need to be present for mandamus against the Secretary of State, and that is some way in which it could be said the Secretary of State is officially, as opposed to informally by reading the newspapers, but officially on notice that this vacancy exists. It would seem anomalous to to mandamus someone to perform a clear legal duty of which he has no notice that the conditions precedent for the duty exist. So that has never, that isn't even in the record before this court. There is no way that you could infer from the record of this court that the Secretary of State even officially knows, other than that his lawyer is here to argue, that the Secretary of State even knows that Judge Escobel's vacancy has occurred, or that his resignation has even been...
But what if, in our opinion, we declared the vacancy to exist and then mandamus the Secretary of State to hold the election?
The only point I'd make about that is that to get to that result, I think the court has to balance some equities that haven't been balanced previously in law, and in some ways depart from some previous interpretations, which of course it can do, and then create the duty for, in effect, create the duty for the first time. And normally mandamus isn't done that way, so it needs to acknowledge you're doing something with mandamus that isn't normally done. For injunction, that's frequently done, to take a case of first impression, make an interpretation for the first time, or depart from the first time from prior interpretations, and then say, therefore, you're enjoined from behaving to the contrary. Mandamus, as far as I'm able to tell, is not done like an injunction because it requires a much higher threshold of duty before someone can be compelled by mandamus. So I think that's the conceptual problem with doing it by mandamus in this case.
Wouldn't it be a ministerial act for the Secretary of State to accept the resignation?
For the Secretary of State to accept the resignation?
To set the elective process in motion? Accept filings?
When there is a vacancy. I mean,
you can see when there is a vacancy,
right,
that
yes,
he has the obligation as a ministerial act to accept filings.
Right. When there is a vacancy, and again, this is the flip side of what I said earlier, you don't want to give the Secretary of State some sort of discretion to say that there's a vacancy, and you don't want to give him, on the other hand, the discretion to say, I nevertheless won't certify a nominee when there is a vacancy. The key thing is, there has to be a vacancy before the Secretary of State can act, before he has any kind of duty. And in this case, it's not so clear in law that the vacancy has occurred, because we're operating in, really this is a vacancy that comes about by inaction. And that is not so clear in law that you can say the Secretary's duty here is so clear and compelling that mandamus is
occurred. You say it's not clear in law. I'm going to go back to the question I asked Mr. Mm-hmm. Wood. Why did the legislature choose to put this language that the resignation must be accepted by the authority in the election code rather than someplace else?
Well, I think that illustrates that it's not, I think the conclusion to draw from that is this is not meant to be a binding of the discretion of the accepting authority. It's something that is meant to set out a fourth condition precedent before there can be the vacancy that triggers the electoral process. If it were meant to be a limit on the discretion of the authority accepting the resignation, then I think it ought to be someplace in the government code defining the powers and authority of the appropriate official, such as the governor, in an acceptance. Which would go beyond the scope merely of election.
If the other side here were to say to you that the reason that sentence is in there, mm-hmm. a resignation must be accepted by that authority, is to prevent this very situation that has occurred, what was your answer to that?
Well, they have said it, I think, in their brief, and my response is that I guess the argument on behalf of the Secretary of State is that looking at the context in which it occurs, it's not the best drafted sentence in the world, but it's more plausible to read it as a fourth condition precedent to making a resignation effective than as that sort of. But since neither side thus far has been able to find legislative history, and I don't know if this amicus from the governor's office has found any, since nobody has found legislative history that'll answer the question for us, I suppose we have to kind of reason it through as to what we think they might have meant.
We have, this court has to determine what the legislature meant, don't we?
Yes. Yes, it does.
Well, there's no indication that the governor has refused to accept.
The letter from his appointment secretary, now that I think is in the record, says the governor won't accept the appointment until November. I don't know if it phrases it in the affirmative or negative. Excuse me?
Won't accept the resignation, set appointment.
Resignation, right. Will not accept the resignation until November of 88. But that's the only expression of the governor's office that we have in the record. But it does say, at least it seems to say for sure, he's not going to accept it for now and not until November of 88.
If the governor's office certified to the Secretary of State that there was a vacancy in a situation where the Secretary of State felt there was some question about it.
Right.
Would the Secretary of State have any discretion there? Or is it your argument it's purely ministerial? That's
right.
A decision the governor's office...
When the Secretary of State receives notification that the governor has accepted a vacancy, accepted a resignation, then I think the Secretary of State has no choice. Even if he has some qualms about it, I think the Secretary of State, as an official, has no discretion to do anything but certify whatever nominee, or accept whatever nominee certified at that point.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
You going to answer Judge Wallace's question first?
Yes, I will.
Okay.
Judge Wallace asked a question about what this all really means insofar as a vacancy is a vacancy is a vacancy. I think if you go back and look at Article 1312A, and that's 13.12A, parentheses A, as adopted in 1967, I think, although once again it could have been drafted better, I think it's quite clear that what the legislature was saying was this. For purposes of beginning the nomination process, the elections process, we're going to consider that the vacancy occurs when, not when the person says he's really resigning out of here, not when he's saying I'm going to leave office, but when the resignation is submitted and accepted. I'll read the language. This was what was put in 67. For the purposes of this section, now this section is nomination and election to fill unexpired terms. For purposes of this section, and I'll skip the stuff about a new office, and where the incumbent of an office has submitted a resignation to become effective at a future date, the vacancy shall be deemed to occur upon the acceptance of the resignation. That, when it says vacancy there, it means vacancy for the purposes of this section, which is Article 1312A, which is nomination and election to fill unexpired terms. I don't believe that one, Judge Esquivel, would have been considered to have to vacate office upon the resignation being effective. And for purposes of nomination elections of this office, to fill the unexpired term of that office. And I think what the legislature was clearly doing is saying, we're going to set up a scheme whereby if we know that office is about to come vacant, the people can fill it, instead of having it filled by appointment.
Does Judge Esquivel have the right then to stay until January 1?
I believe Judge Esquivel has the right to stay in that office.
What if he resigned effective March 1? Or effective March 1, 1990? He still has to have an election.
I can, as we said in law school, we have horrible imaginables and imaginable horribles. I can imagine situations here where it would become absurd.
But I mean, here it's about 40 days. He's asking to stay over about 40 more days than he would be entitled to, and that's okay.
Well,
120 days.
Here is a situation which I believe is within the contemplation of the legislature. January 1 is the normal time that these offices change, when they change.
Half of this court is going to change in November.
I understand that in these circumstances, in these unusual circumstances, that's going to be true, but I don't think it's without the contemplation of the legislature to feel that it was certainly unreasonable that this office should change occupants on January 1. In fact, I think that's the normal thing that the legislature would be thinking about. So, yes, I can imagine horribles where this legislation obviously needs to be limited or that this court would consider to be an unreasonable application of the statute. But I don't think that this case in any way presents that situation. Now, let me say a word about the Sawyer case, because I think the Sawyer case is really off point in this situation. And it may be that the Sawyer case was not, when it was presented to this court, was not very well briefed. There is a point in the Sawyer case that I think that really shows you what Sawyer was all about. In discussing whether or not acceptance should be required, the court said on page 401, acceptance is required in order that the public interest may suffer no inconvenience for want of a public servant to execute the law. Now, that is the almost exact language that comes out of two earlier, one a Supreme Court case, about resignations where public officials were trying to avoid their duties in office. They were trying to, in effect, what they were trying to do was resign before some distasteful duty faced them. This has not been cited to the court, and it's in response to the respondent's brief. Jones versus the City of Jefferson, and I'm trying to, it's a Texas Supreme Court case, 1886. Trying to get the exact site. And I don't seem to have the exact site. I will get it to you before I leave today and file it with the clerk. The Supreme Court was dealing with a situation where someone was basically trying to avoid his duties by leaving office. And what the court held was is that you can't do that because our Constitution declares that all officers shall hold on until their successors are elected and qualified. And an officer whose resignation has been tendered to the proper authority, accepted, continues in office for the purposes of fulfilling that public policy of not letting someone run out on their job. There is a follow-up case to that case, which is...
So what you're saying is that if the governor does not accept the resignation, and we do not agree with him, Judge Escobedo is going to be a judge whether or not he wants to be one or not after.
Oh, in that situation, I think that if you accept the premise that he can never extricate himself until the governor accepts that resignation, that same line of reasoning is in Keene versus Featherston, and once again, it's Court of Appeals, Austin, 1902, and it's the same exact situation. What they're saying is that the public policy is taken care of by the holdover provisions in our statutes. Now, we all know those holdover provisions may have some limitations, but that is really what Sawyer's talking about. Sawyer's talking about a situation where the public policy was you wanted someone to stay in that office to do those duties and not be able to avoid those duties. It was not talking about a situation that was related to filling a vacancy or electing officers versus appointing them. Now, I heard a while ago that we were looking for public policy considerations. The statute obviously is subject to different interpretations. And we're looking for public policy, and I think there was a question about was the fact that a person might be able to withdraw their resignation be a matter of public policy. I clearly cannot see how that could ever be a matter of public policy. Obviously, the governor has authority to accept that resignation. And once that resignation is accepted, I don't think anyone would argue that he could withdraw. And he could accept it the minute he got it, or she got it. And that would cut off any ability to withdraw. So the fact that you want to give the person time to withdraw can't be an issue because that is cut off by acceptance. So that policy just simply doesn't exist. Now, what we have here is a situation that is about as close to the case of Kilday versus Germany as you can get. They were faced there with a statute that if you read it on its face, a situation that if you looked at it purely from how the the law read at that time that they would have to say Mr. Kilday has in effect been appointed by Mr. Sadler to that office. That Supreme Court said we're not going to indulge in that kind of interpretation. There may be some horribles here. There's no question that the Kilday Court recognized that Mr. Sadler may not have resigned. They recognized that he might have a fuss about whether or not he was still holding that office or not, but they said the electoral process is too important for us to speculate about what's going to happen down the road. In fact, it did happen. Jerry came back and filed a lawsuit. They said, we're not going to speculate about that. And Mr. Kilday, if there's not a vacancy, then you're kind of wasting your time here, but we're going to make that electoral process occur. In spite of everything that was cited by the respondent in this case of saying the law is this and the law is that, they said we're not going to interpret it that way. And what we're faced here is with one inescapable conclusion, and that is if a resignation must be accepted by that authority, if it doesn't mean what it says, then what it has to be interpreted to mean is that the governor has unbridled discretion to hold on to resignations, create appointments, affect the legislative process anytime that governor gets ready. And I don't care whether that governor is a Democrat or Mark Fyfe or Governor Clements. I do not think that that is the proper interpretation of the statute.
You reject the suggestion from the Attorney General that you're pursuing the wrong remedy.
In all honesty, Judge Phillips, I hadn't considered that possibility that I could enjoin the governor and the district court for two reasons. One, I know there's conflicting authority on that, and two, it certainly wouldn't be an effective remedy at this point. We're going to try to go through the district courts and to come up through the appellate courts. We have long since had the election before we could get that matter resolved. And it's simply not an effective remedy, and I think that is something that mandamus affords you is when you have no other effective remedy. I don't believe that's an effective remedy if it exists, and I haven't briefed myself to the point where I'm convinced that it exists.
Do you think Secretary of State has discretion to refuse to put a race on the ballot when the governor says there has been a resignation?
I'd like to point something out that, I'll answer that, but I'd like to point something out here. There is sort of this assumption here that the governor has some official duty to tell the Secretary of State that a resignation exists, that he's accepted it. There is absolutely nothing in the statute that says that.
What is acceptance?
There is nothing in the statute that says, governor, whenever you decide to accept this resignation, you've got to tell the Secretary of State. That's not in the statutes. Not there. Secretary of State has no official statutory method by which to know when the governor is accepted. And I assume what happens, in fact, I'm sure of what happens, is that the governor unofficially, because there's no official method to do it, to tell the Secretary of State, say, I've accepted this resignation. I'm sure that's how it's been happening.
Is there no, I can't even remember the name of it, but the records of the governor's office where they were, that's in the custody of the Secretary of State where official acts the governor does or written down in the Secretary of State's office?
There is certainly the governor files.
There was during the Republic of Texas.
The governor files all sorts of documents with the Secretary of State, but there is absolutely nothing to indicate that when the governor accepts the resignation that he's supposed to do anything. There is one thing that is clear. The party here has to take cognizance of that because they have to, when they certify to the Secretary of State why they're filling a vacancy, they have to put on that form, and that's a statutory form as to why they're filling it. The Secretary of State's in a position here where it's not a matter of the governor telling the Secretary of State. There's nothing official that the governor does to tell the Secretary of State. I'm sure he notifies him that I've done it. But that's not a defense. If a vacancy exists for purposes of this statute, if it exists, the Secretary of State has no discretion. They have to put that place on the ballot. And in this particular situation, in the Kilday case, the court simply said, we're going to hold this election. Mr. Sadler wants to argue about whether he resigned at some later date because they state in here that the governor has never indicated where he accepted that resignation or not. We're going to hold this election. Mr. Sadler can worry about that some other time.
Well, in this particular case before us now, it's really a moot question because Secretary of State appears here this morning through his lawyer. He's on notice. He's in court. He's been notified of the alleged vacancy. So really, it gets down again to whether or not there's a vacancy, doesn't it?
That's correct, John.
A vacancy or whether or not the governor has accepted the resignation?
Well, if it's a vacancy for the purposes of this statute, we're saying that there is an acceptance as a matter of law, that the governor, this court should not construe this statute in such a manner that the governor would have unbridled discretion to prevent those election process from ever beginning. And the term vacancy, I believe, that's used here is termed a vacancy for purposes of filling this office by election. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you for
your presentation. That concludes the business of the court for the day. The marshal will please adjourn the court.
The audience, please rise. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.